Welcome to the Center of Everywhere podcast, where we explore stories of rural Minnesotans who are making a difference in their communities. Rural isn't in the middle of nowhere. It is in the center of everywhere.
And welcome to the Center of Everywhere podcast. I'm Kelly Ash, Senior Researcher at the Center for Rural Policy and Development. We are a private, nonpartisan, nonprofit organization based in rural Minnesota, where we are dedicated to providing data-driven research on rural issues to help our policymakers make more informed decisions affecting the rural people and places of our state. Today, I'm talking with Scott McMahon, the Executive Director of the Greater Minnesota Partnership, and we're discussing proposed legislation that's going to be impacting housing development in Minnesota. Thanks for being here, Scott. Really appreciate your time.
Well, I appreciate the opportunity, Kelly.
So as many listeners probably know, we've talked about housing shortages for quite a few years now, and rural Minnesota still dealing with this issue. And the shortage has kind of a few impacts. One of the main ones is, you know, we also have a labor force shortage across all of Minnesota. It's pretty severe in rural areas. And housing has been identified as one area in which our ability to attract and grow our workforce has been impeded by the lack of housing available. We also struggle with providing more appropriate housing for our aging population, our seniors. And then also, we've talked a little bit about how it's making it more difficult to take advantage of the shifts in migration that we've seen from metro to rural areas over the last 3 to 4 years. And so housing's kind of playing a central role, and it's come up a lot at the legislature. And I know the Greater Minnesota Partnership has been advocating for state investment in rural housing for quite a few years, and it kind of culminated, I feel like, in 2023 when you guys successfully advocated to bring in $39 million to the Greater Minnesota Workforce Housing Development Fund. I believe the largest amount of money it's ever received in that fund. So congratulations on that.
Thank you, Kelly.
And then so hot on the heels of that, the legislature has decided they're not finished with housing. Still a big issue. And so a number of bills are being introduced this session. And what's interesting, it's kind of a non-budget year, right? So they're really focused on the regulatory aspects of housing rather than the financial. And what's interesting is, you know, a lot of times when it involves money, it can be controversial. But this time we're actually talking about regulations, usually not as controversial, but it's been a little controversial. There's been a lot of articles written about this housing issue. Lots of interesting different organizations and groups involved in the development of this housing. And you know, at the Center for Rural Policy and Development, I feel like a lot of our research and what we end up talking about is, you know, legislation that is implemented statewide and the different kinds of impacts it might have in a metro area versus a rural area. This is potentially another one of those pieces that could have wide-ranging impacts, but it might vary quite a bit depending on if you're living in an urban area versus a rural area. And so, Scott, why don't we start out with, you know, what are some of the pieces of legislation that's coming up and kind of talk a little bit about, what it's meant to do?
Yeah, you know, that's a great kickoff point. So there are a number of bills floating around in the House and Senate to get at trying to create a policy and regulatory structure that will allow the state to maximize the impact of the $1 billion that went into housing last year. So you highlighted the $39 million that we got into the Greater Minnesota Workforce Housing Grant Program. We also got an additional $8 million in a new program to help us build out the public infrastructure needed for more housing. But above and beyond that, you know, we had a total $1 billion investment. And one of the things we're trying to address in the state is getting our housing stock back into equilibrium with demand. So right now, in the most recent numbers that we've come across in the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency is when you look at kind of our natural growth rate for new housing, we're about 50,000 units off from that. They say it's about 40,000 single family homes, about 10,000 rental properties. And that really is, it's a bubble that developed with kind of the Great Recession. As if we can all look way back then, pre-pandemic, going back to the Great Recession in the early mid 2000s. And so this just kind of drifted through our economy over the past decade and a half. And the impact that it's having is in the metro area, it's really impacting the price of housing. It's making things more expensive. It's simple economics 101. You know, when you have a supply-demand mismatch, and demand is much higher than supply, you're going to get price pressures on there, and we're seeing that play out. You know, when you're seeing new construction for housing starting off at $700,000 for a new home, it's not affordable for a lot of your population. And so we want to see more housing stock get built. Everybody wants to see that. We want to see it in a proper mix of the types of housing that people are looking for. And we need it in all corners of the state. And so the proposals floating around are trying to figure out how do we get rid of some of the barriers that may exist in getting housing built. And so they kind of fall into a couple different buckets. One of them is how do we allow more places where houses can be built? And so some of the bills look at increasing density by requiring smaller lot sizes, allowing more housing units on a given parcel of land, and then the other side of it then is providing more places where we can put in multifamily and affordable housing, and that's to try and counter, in addition to just where we can build, it's intended to counter some of the political constraints that happen around housing developments. You know, a lot of folks who have been in community conversations about new developments, about multifamily or affordable housing, at times you can have a lot of not in my backyard aspects come into those conversations that do at times make it harder to play out. And then kind of the third bucket is what they're calling the aesthetic side of things, where we're trying to limit the mandates that can come into play on housing development, on mandating, you know, number of garage stalls, types of exterior things used, things that at times can increase the cost of producing a housing unit. So that's kind of the quick summation of what the bills are intended to do. Now, the reality is, and I think this is where you want to go with the conversation, Kelly, is what does that mean when it's out in the ground and it hits communities and where things go from there? So I think that's probably where we're headed for the rest of the conversation here.
Yeah, and so a lot of the conversation, and it seems like from what I have read, and it hasn't been super deep, but what I've gathered is a lot of the legislation is kind of in response to things that occur quite frequently in metropolitan areas. I'll think of, for example, I think it's the Minneapolis 2040 plan. Is that right? Or 23, 2040 plan, right? And
24,
so, yeah, and a lot of metropolitan areas, suburban as well, across the United States has identified more density as being part of the solution in terms of having more affordable housing. How do we take these maybe traditional single family home lots and turn those into multifamily units, right? And with that comes along some NIMBYism from some of the neighborhoods, right? I don't want higher density in my neighborhood, or some of the regulations that a city or suburb might put in, be like, all right, it's got to be this square footage and you got to have a three car stall and all of these things, right? These aren't things, in my opinion, and you could correct me if I'm wrong, Scott, we don't typically see that in rural areas as being part of the issue. It's not necessarily about creating more density, while at the same time, I don't know if we would see the pushback that you would have from some of the NIMBYism you do see in metropolitan areas and suburban areas. Am I reading that correctly, or what are your thoughts?
Yeah, you are, Kelly. And you know, I want to hit on a couple of realities we face. So one of the challenges that we face in Greater Minnesota, and I've talked about this on past podcasts with you, and it's something I share frequently with legislators, is state policymakers. So the Minnesota House of Representatives, the Minnesota Senate, the governor, really like to try and solve problems with policies they can implement statewide. The reality is, it's not often that a one size fits all solution works everywhere. And that's often, there's often a dividing point between what's going on in the metropolitan area and what's going on in Greater Minnesota and our rural communities. And housing is one of those areas where you have that impact. So, you know, right now, I always kind of say we have two different markets for housing in Minnesota. We have the Twin Cities market, and we have the Greater Minnesota market. And if you did a Venn diagram on them, they'd be two circles a mile apart from each other. there simply just is very little commonality between what's happening in the housing market in the Twin Cities and what's happening in rural and greater Minnesota. And let me give you two examples on this one. The first one I alluded to previously is that you can build a new house in the Twin Cities and it's gonna market, it's gonna sell quickly, but it's gonna sell for an astronomical price. And that's being driven by our supply demand mismatch. In greater Minnesota, and I've got to give the Center for Rural Policy and Development kudos for this. You know, the study you guys put out back in 2019, I think, that looked at the housing realities in greater Minnesota really shined a light on what our market is. And the conclusions you guys came to, and they still hold true today, we see this nonstop on housing developments, is that the prices that our economies can support for new housing development, even at market rate, based off of wages, are lower than what it's going to cost to build that unit. So, you know, an example is if you build a single family home and it costs $325,000 to build, the bank and the appraiser are going to say that property is worth $250,000 when it's done. So that homeowner has to come up with a 20% down payment just to get into the house, plus a $75,000 gap finance to make it work. And we see the same thing play out on the multifamily side. You know, we've got examples throughout greater Minnesota where you build a new multifamily apartment building that costs $6.5 million to build, but it appraises fully filled, rent maximized at $4 million. So they're just two completely different marketplaces that we're dealing with. The second layer on this one is in the metropolitan area, you're pretty well built out. You know, there's not an overabundance of developable land, at least in the urban core, the first ring, second ring suburbs. You still see developable land and out in the exurbs and that side of it. And so if we're looking at more housing in the Twin Cities, density is going to be a key part of that. You know, how do we get more opportunities on a given parcel of land in order to build the housing where our economy is saying it needs to be? And obviously, we want housing opportunities to be close to employment opportunities, close to recreation opportunities, and so on and so forth. So these pressures all kind of play in. Well, let's go out to greater Minnesota. The lack of developable land isn't really our issue. You know, all of our cities are surrounded by open land. I mean, obviously, it's farmland and other things right now, but you don't have the situation where, you know, Wilmer borders Alexandria. You know, you've got a, you know, and in a lot of these areas, you've got 15, 20, 30-minute drive before you get to the next community. And so we don't have those same pressures. At the same time, in our communities, a lot of times it's cheaper to build out than it is to build up or to build dense. And so they're very different markets. And the reality is, policy interventions are probably going to address one of those two markets, but rarely you're going to have a situation in which you address both markets. And when you do state policies that affect one market and don't have a positive impact on the other market, you may in fact have a situation where you have a negative impact on the other market. And that's what we're seeing in some of these proposals that are coming forward, is that they have the potential to make our housing situations or economic situations in our communities worse off as a result of the state policies versus the benefit the policymakers are trying to get.
Yeah, it's interesting when you think about this, and let's, for example, kind of ground it a bit. So if I'm a community and economic developer in a metropolitan area, I kind of feel like housing development is going to occur, and more that the local government's role is having appropriate zoning, making things work out, and making sure the developer is paying for everything that needs to be put in. Community and economic development in a rural area that's dealing with housing is more about, okay, how do we subsidize to make this attractive for a developer to come in? It's more about, hey, maybe we'll lay down some of the infrastructure for you. You don't have to pay for that. Don't worry about it. Or we TIF district this somehow, right? Like it's more along those lines. How do we make this an attractive piece? Because I think in a lot of rural areas, there is demand for housing. There are people out there that will purchase housing, even with some of those financial gaps, but you kind of have to have a little bit of subsidy and government backing to make it work, particularly in the local government. So let's say, for example, I'm here in New London, Minnesota, and we have a similar situation where we kind of have the city limits. We've expanded, we have some land. They're talking about doing some development around here, and it's largely in the single family units or maybe even some of those patio style condo homes, right, for seniors and things like that. How would this, some of these proposed legislation, how would that impact, let's say, New London's ability to, purchase the land, put in the infrastructure, and make it attractive for developers to come in and make financial sense for a developer to put some housing on that land?
Frankly, there is very little in these proposals that will have a net positive impact on new housing being constructed in Greater Minnesota. There are some areas where, you may see some one-offs happen, but the policies actually interject some challenges for us. And let me wander through that a little bit. So one of the proposals would upzone all residential properties across the state of Minnesota. So every residential lot, right now, a lot of them in Greater Minnesota are single family lots. Those lots would need to accommodate at least two housing units. So if you have two housing units on a property, you need to be able to accommodate two water lines, wastewater lines coming out of the property, going into your sewer, and the volume that those two housing properties are going to have. In addition, on that lot, if a developer is going to build housing that is either all electric or qualifies as affordable housing, that by right they can develop up to four housing units on that one lot. So now you're talking four sewer lines coming in, four water lines going in, electric capacity for four housing units. And then in some situations, if you're near a commercial district, that lot needs to be able to support up to an eightplex. So you just get a lot of volume going in those situations. Now, one of those things on its own may not be a problem, but at some point, you're going to hit the point in which our infrastructure is overtaxed and overutilized and has to be upgraded. And the reality is our Greater Minnesota local governments are not, they're not wealthy communities. They don't have large tax bases. They don't have a lot of an industry there. They may have an industry here or there, but it's not a really a diverse economy in a lot of situations. And so the ability for the local governments to make the investment to support the infrastructure to accommodate the wide swath of development that could happen when you upzone every parcel of land in a community just isn't feasible. And the development's not going to happen across all of those, but the cities have to assume that the development can happen on each of those parcels. And so they have to plan that these things may happen anywhere. Versus right now, what our cities do with their zoning policies is try and guide development and kind of say, we're pro-density, but we can't do density everywhere. We're going to focus the infrastructure support in these areas. So I always kind of say to with policymakers, take a city and cut it into a checkerboard, and you've got 12 equal squares in this community. The cities don't have the capacity to say, we can build up and support the infrastructure in all 12, but we can do the infrastructure in three of them. And so we're going to make the investment and we're going to promote and encourage dense development in these three sectors of the city. And we can do it, but we can't say we can do it everywhere. And on the other side, as you were indicating, for us to make that density in those three checker squares that I referenced, it takes local support too. So they may turn that into a TIF district, tax increment financing district, to try and pull some of the increment off to help finance that development. They're probably going to use tax abatement. They're probably going to waive hookup fees. They're probably going to do some other things to make it happen. And whenever I talk development, housing development, especially multifamily in Greater Minnesota, the thing that always gets brought up is on talking about the financing is the word stacking. And that means that you get the cost of your project is going to be, $6 million. And traditional financing may cover $4 million. And you've got to figure out how to close that $2 million gap that exists there. And so you start layering in these different tools to try and close it. And you hope you have enough tools to close that full $2 million gap in order to do it. Now, where this proposal comes into play, that may have that negative impact on us is as cities have to think about how they invest in their infrastructure, this policy may force them to build up capacity at a cost that's never going to come to fruition as far as where it's going to come into play. And so what that does is adds more cost onto the back end of the development. And so what may have been a $6 million project with a $2 million gap might then become a $6.25 million project with a $2.25 million gap. And it just makes it harder. And every time we talk about closing these gaps, we're not talking about private financing coming in. We're talking about the public financing and how do we get state or federal or local resources to fill that gap. And so, I have had a number of conversations with legislators about this bill, and they say, well, can't you just pass those costs on the developers? And my response is, I can't pass that $2 million cost on the developers. And so any additional cost that comes into play is going to come into that gap, and it's going to have to be either the local government, the state government, the federal government finding resources to make these things happen, or the development's not going to happen. And when you get into the development not happening, the implication of that is, we have demand, as you mentioned, for housing. Every week I'm talking to a CEO of one of our companies who says, I want to grow, but I can't grow until we get more housing in this community. And at some point, if we can't meet their housing needs, those jobs are going to go somewhere else. Either, they're going to make investments in other places, and we're seeing that. We're seeing investment move from Minnesota to places like Fargo and elsewhere. We need to figure out how to keep those investments here. And we can't do that if we can't get the housing that our employers need.
Well, and you bring up a good point. Well, one, I think this question about, oh, can't you pass it on to developers, right? Like, that's our issue is we don't have developers developing in our rural areas because it's not super profitable, right? And so by raising the costs, it makes it even less likely that a developer is going to come in without the local government. And largely, it's going to be passed on to local property taxpayers, right, in the community that are going to have to foot the bill for a little bit. And so what's interesting for a rural area is like we're trying to fill our workforce, but also cities will sometimes throw in that investment to entice a developer to come in with the idea that, oh, the property taxes we make off this new housing will pay back. But if you're just making it more expensive, it's making that economies of scale not work as well, right? But you brought up the other comment about kind of our border cities. And right away when I started reading about this, I was like, oh man, like Fargo, Moorhead, Grand Forks, all of our cities, Marshall, that are kind of on the border there that already struggle a little bit because it is a little bit pricier to build housing in Minnesota. Man, things like this that are just going to increase the cost more. I can't imagine like Fargo, Moorhead being super excited about stuff like this when it's already kind of a struggle with Fargo and competition across the border. Am I reading that correctly?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I mean, the reality, Kelly, is all these markets are local markets. What you're experiencing in London may not be what Owatonna is experiencing. It may not be what Mankato is experiencing. And so these communities all need to have their local ability to figure out how to deal with their challenges. And they're all doing things. I can hear stories every time I go into one of our greater Minnesota communities about the tremendous lift and effort that our city leaders, our business leaders are trying to do to get housing built in their communities. But they're all trying to solve it differently because it's their own local reality, it's their own local economy, it's their own local housing needs. And even just from the product that you need. Some communities it is single family home ownership that they need. In some communities it's multifamily rentals that they need. In some communities it's senior living to get mom and dad out of the inappropriate house that they're living in into something more appropriate to open up the 3-bedroom upstairs house for a family to move into. And so, from a policy standpoint, we should be not looking at mandating communities to behave in one way. We should be trying to figure out ways to incent communities to be able to address their challenges, to give them the tools to be able to do it. And some of these things that will get us to the point of building more housing. You know, as I said a few minutes ago, these proposals aren't going to encourage new housing development in Greater Minnesota. We need to figure out the bills that do encourage and promote and help make more housing happen in the 80 counties that we represent.
Yeah, so tell me a little bit. You said you've been meeting with legislators. Obviously, a lot of times, what I have learned in my years too is that a lot of these things are good intentions, sometimes just some misunderstandings, not always super knowledgeable about how things will play out in the ground, particularly in rural areas. Have you found legislators willing to listen and kind of think about this in terms of how it might impact Greater Minnesota?
You know, Kelly, we've got 201 legislators in the state of Minnesota, 67 in the Senate, 134 in the House, and they're all different people and they're all different personalities. And so we kind of run the gamut on that. We have some who, you know, come to the table and say, yes, I absolutely want to hear your story. I want to figure out what we can do. Let's do this together. And we have some who, when I tell them that, you know, our market is upside down and adding $10,000 to the cost of a project can kill it, they don't understand how that can be real. And so that's kind of the spectrum that we deal with at the Capitol in trying to get folks to understand what the experience is in Greater Minnesota and how things function. You know, we were fortunate last summer and fall, Senator Port, the chair of the Senate Housing Committee, spent a couple of weeks traveling Greater Minnesota. She took a trip with some of her committee staff and members from Duluth to Thief River Falls, and then in the fall went from Rochester to Worthington and heard a lot of the unique challenges we have in Greater Minnesota. And that experience has helped her shape her understanding of how policy needs to interact with these different things. And so, you know, she has a better understanding about how difficult it is to get these projects done, how important stacking is on this, and how, you know, state policies limit the impact of things like taxing and financing on actually being able to address the challenges from a given community standpoint. So, you know, we run the gamut. The important thing is that groups like the Greater Minnesota Partnership are at the Capitol meeting with legislators, telling the Greater Minnesota story, keeping these issues in front of them, and when needed, turning the political heat up on our policymakers to try and get them to make the decisions that we need in our communities to address our challenges.
It's an ongoing saga in terms of legislation being passed. I'm thinking about childcare. I'm thinking about other topics where we've had similar situations, you know, good intentions, statewide policies being passed down. And then those impacts kind of play out in very different ways according to where you live and what part of the state you're in. And it's all local. But what's been interesting, going back to the childcare thing, is we've seen a lot of really good local solutions pop up. Right? Like a lot of cities and communities and employers and nonprofits are getting involved. Even the state has provided a lot of grant funding to kind of figure out like how do we solve the shortage in childcare? And there's a lot of really interesting things coming along. And it kind of seems like again here for housing, you know, particularly in rural areas, there's a lot of really good local solutions. People are coming up with some ideas. We're finding some local developers to figure it out. It's kind of like just don't get in our way right now. Support us. Don't make it harder. Is that kind of the main message?
You know, Kelly, you might as well register as a lobbyist because you just told my story. I mean, that's exactly what it is. Please do not do anything this session that makes it hard. It's already hard enough. Please do not make it any harder for us. But again, it's a challenge when you have policymakers who want to do statewide policies and you have two completely different marketplaces and policies can have a significant impact one area and a significant negative impact in the other area. And so it's a lot of conversations, it's a lot of educating, it's a lot of working through these things to try and get where we are. But we are seeing a lot of movement on these things. You know, the Senate bill they're working on right now looks very different than the collection of packages that they first heard. But we're still not there on it. There's still some challenges that that bill presents for Greater Minnesota. And just this week, we saw some pretty significant movement in the House on these bills, where it used to be a package that dealt with both this upzoning of all properties and different buy right opportunities for folks who are trying to build multifamily and affordable housing. Those used to be combined. They've now separated them, and there's a bill focused on that multifamily and affordable, which is probably the vehicle that's going to be moving on this front if we're going to see something in this session. But even that bill presents challenges for us, because what that bill does is gives developers by right the ability to develop multifamily or affordable housing on any commercial property across the state. Well, a lot of our communities don't have a lot of commercial going on, and so we need to maintain that tax base. We need to have a place for our businesses to be able to function. And so there's still kind of a ripple effect that can play out with some of these things. So we're going to keep working with the authors and the chambers on these issues. And I'm optimistic we can get to a point in the coming weeks on pulling together a bill that at least doesn't hurt Greater Minnesota. I don't think we're gonna get to a point on this package of policy bills that help Greater Minnesota. But I think we can get to a point where it doesn't make it harder for us to build housing.
Well, Scott, thanks a lot for the conversation and providing the context. Thanks for all the work that you do. I know it's not easy. It's much easier to be the researcher on the side of things rather than the person that has to talk to everybody and tell them some of the problems and issues. So, really appreciate what you do, Scott, and good luck the rest of the session. And I'm sure Julie will be reconnecting with you, and we'll have an end of session kind of briefing to see how things went.
Well, I appreciate that, Kelly, and I can't say how much we appreciate the work that you all do. The research that you do really serves as the bedrock for a lot of how we can explain these challenges to policymakers, whether it's your housing studies, your childcare studies, work you guys have done on workforce, and so on and so forth. We appreciate the work that you guys are doing. It makes it easier for us to tell the story of what's actually going on in Greater Minnesota. So thank you for all the work that you do, and thank your supporters for allowing you to do the work that you guys do.
You've been listening to the Center of Everywhere podcast, where we explore stories of rural Minnesotans who are making a difference in their communities. Rural isn't in the middle of nowhere. It is in the center of everywhere.